Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. For film critics, some years are just better for movies than others. Take 1939, there's Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz. Or think of 1974, The Godfather Part II, Chinatown, and Blazing Saddles. Well, my guest today, the critic and author Brian Raftery, argues definitively, positively, it's 1999. The Matrix, Fight Club, Boys Don't Cry, my favorite, The Insider, or American Beauty, which that music you just heard just comes from. This hour, On Point, was 1999 our best year in movies? Join us. What's your take on 1999? Was it a winner or overrated? What do you remember of that year's films? And what makes a good movie year anyway? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from New York City, Brian Raftery. He's a movie critic who's written for Wired, GQ, Rolling Stone, Entertainment Weekly, among others. His new book is Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. It contains a lot of interviews with a lot of directors and producers and actors involved at the time. You can read an excerpt of it on our website, onpointradio.org. Brian, great to have you here today.
Thanks for having me, David.
All right. I feel like a different character from the 1990s, Judge Wapner, who's like, all right, welcome to the People's Court. I've read your complaint. Now make your case. So, Brian, make your case. Why 99? Why is it best year ever?
Well, you can certainly, you know, on a very basic level, you can look at the movies of that year. And aside from the ones you mentioned, I mean, you have Fight Club and The Matrix, obviously, but you also have stuff like Being John Malkovich or The Blair Witch Project or The Sixth Sense. And sort of I feel like that year, movie audiences got sort of everything they wanted. It feels like the filmmakers got to make what the movies they wanted. The studios sort of won over the audiences by kind of pushing them in these new directions. And I think audiences, you know, in the movie industry, there's something called a four-quadrant movie, which is a movie that kind of satisfies every single possible demographic. And I feel like 1999 was kind of a four-quadrant year. There was just really something for everyone. I mean, it was Notting Hill. There was The Best Man. It was a very varied year. But I don't know if it's just the movies. You know, you mentioned 1939, and I think if you look at 1999, it feels like the previous 70, 80 years of film history were kind of compressed into one year. You had the really big spectacles that were, you know, something like The Matrix owes a big debt to The Wizard of Oz. Or, you know, you had all these indie movies which really kind of captured the spirit of what was going on in the 60s and 70s in American film. So it's a very varied year.
All right. So we're going to talk about a bunch of them over the course of this hour. I guess we should start with one at the top. You heard the music. It won a passel of awards, American Beauty. So let's hear a clip from that. In American Beauty, Kevin Spacey plays 42-year-old Lester Burnham, and we'll talk about Kevin Spacey later. But nonetheless, Kevin Spacey plays this key figure. He's a suburban dad, sick of his job, sick of his wife, sick of his life. He quits his job and becomes infatuated with his high school daughter's best friend, Angela. In this scene, Lester talks to his daughter, Janie, that's played by Thora Birch, and her friend, Angela, who's played by Mina Suvari. It's after a cheerleading dance during which Lester fantasizes about his daughter's friend, Angela. So creepy.
So what are you girls doing now?
Dad, we're going out for pizza.
Oh, really? Do you need a ride? We can give you a ride. I have a car. You want to come with us?
Thanks, but I have a car.
Well, you have a car. Oh, well, that's great. That's great. Because Janie's thinking about getting a car, too, soon, aren't you?
Honey? Dad, Mom's waiting for you.
Well, it was very nice meeting you, Angela. Any friend of Janie's is a friend of mine.
Woof. So, Brian Raftery, tell us about that film. Why does it win Best Picture? And what is that? What is the enduring resonance of that film?
Well, that was a very interesting year for that to win Best Picture, because if you think of the movies that weren't nominated, like Election or Being John Malkovich, but I think what people responded to in American Beauty was, I think that movie, like a lot of the films of that year, was a little bit ahead of its time. That movie was plugging into a lot of very big ideas about where we were sort of headed as a culture. I mean, I think at the time people were like, you know, American Beauty, isn't this a little cartoonish? This movie about these kids who are obsessed with violence and this guy who lives in the suburbs and is kind of a you know, Kevin Spacey's neighbor is like a neo-Nazi sympathizer. And all those things now, it honestly, 20 years later, that movie feels a lot more ahead of its time than it was received at that moment. And, you know, it was also very important because it was Sam Mendes' first movie. And in 1999, you have Spike Jonze making his first movie, Sofia Coppola making her first movie. You know, Brad Bird makes The Iron Giant his first movie. So it was one of many big sort of premieres, sort of an introduction to the next 20 years of filmmaking.
And you have a bunch of people in the book talking. I think, I mean, my God, you had really big names in there. A lot of the stars of these things, the movies that you're writing about, a lot of the producers behind them and a lot of the directors as well. But they said, you know, it seemed as though you were like, hey, is 99 really all that? And they said, oh, yeah, now that you say it, it really was. It sounded as though they're kind of confirming where you were going with this, that they felt this was a year that kind of was a hub from which a lot of spokes emanated.
Yeah, I mean, they lived through it. And one thing that's really interesting when you talk to people about the late 90s is that, and one of the reasons why this year kind of happened is Hollywood was kind of in a weird state by the end of the 90s. They were, you know, they just had Titanic, which was the biggest movie of all time at that point. But there were all of these weird TV adaptations and sequels. There was the famous, you know, Batman and Robin. There was The Odd Couple 2, a sequel no one remembers being made but was actually produced.
Or needed to be made.
No, needed to be made, yeah. And I think one thing that people kind of realized by the late 90s was we have, you know, there's this entire movement going on of independent film and of MTV and commercials. And we need to pull in these new voices. And that's how you get a movie like Three Kings, which is, you know, David O. Russell, who'd made two really strong kind of indie comedies that were critically beloved and did pretty well. You know, he gets to make a big budget Warner Brothers movie in the desert with George Clooney and Ice Cube and Mark Wahlberg. And so these sort of opportunities just did not happen a lot except for that late period.
Hey, Brian, let's play a clip from that. It's a,
sure.
I remember that film very well. David O. Russell, right? It was a very funny and very dark film. Three Kings is set in Iraq just after the end of the Gulf War. There are four American soldiers played by George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, Ice Cube, and Spike Jonze. They steal a cache of Saddam Hussein's hidden gold. They end up helping anti-Saddam dissidents by escorting them to the Iranian border. In this scene, while tromping through the desert with the civilians from Iraq, the well, how should I put this? Let's just say not-so-bright Conrad, played by Spike Jonze, asked the Iraqis about their impression of America.
Y'all think America's Satan, right? America's Satan?
No, احنا كل ما نتمنى انا واخوي يكون عندنا صالون حلاقه.
اي صالون حلاقه.
What they say?
They say he wants salon.
A what?
A salon, hair salon.
You cut hair?
Yes, yes, yes.
Look, they don't care if they cut American hair, Shiite hair, Sunni hair. They just want to get rid of Saddam and live life, make business. Do you want to kill every Arab?
That's what I was trained to do.
No, that was not our training. We got Arab allies, man.
Yeah, well, we got Arab allies.
A scene reflecting, I guess, some of the confusion about some folks about why we were there, I guess. What was the movie's significance for you? Why does it stay with you?
It's kind of a remarkable film. I mean, you listen to that clip and you think this is a Warner Brothers movie. This is a big studio putting at least $55, $60 million in a movie that's taking a huge movie star, putting him in the desert and basically questioning the last 10 years of U.S. foreign policy. And that's an incredibly exciting idea for a big studio film, the kind you really would not get made these days. And I think that movie is, for a generation that had not had its own version of MASH or Paths of Glory, that was a very strong anti-war film and a really, really funny one as well. It's a great movie. It's one of my top five of that year for sure.
Do you think it's an influencer or do you think, like, to me, it reminds me of the movie version of MASH in some ways. I think you make a reference to that also in your book, you know, sort of bleak comedies that are talking a bit about Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell with Three Kings. It's one of those movies that I think filmmakers and audiences really loved it that year. I don't know if it's permeated in the same way that, you know, something like The Matrix or Fight Club has, but I do think filmmakers look to a movie like Three Kings and say, you know, if you can marshal the kind of resources, which is a big budget and a very, very pro-risk studio like Warner Brothers was at that point, you can kind of make these incredibly singular films that are not only really entertaining but are really trying to say something.
Let's talk about The Matrix. If you only saw the third installment of The Matrix, you may have just sort of walked away thinking it wasn't much different than Battlefield Earth. Nonetheless, the first one hit me kind of like a thunderclap. In The Matrix, Keanu Reeves plays Neo, a software techie by day, a computer hacker by night. In this scene, Rebel and sort of Messiah, Morpheus, first meets Neo. Neo will come to realize the real world is just a wasteland and humans are now controlled by machines and an artificial reality called The Matrix. Here's Morpheus, played by Lawrence Fishburne.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know, you can't explain. but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Apparently, I wasn't the only one being hit by a thunderclap, I guess. we've only got about a minute or so left before the break, but tell us a little bit about The Matrix. What was it? What did it capture?
I think it captured a lot of anxiety we had about the sort of coming deadline of the new millennium. I mean, that is a movie that is really questioning how far and how fast we're being taken by technology, what our role is in technology, and also, like a lot of movies of that year, was really pushing this idea of, are you who you want to be and can you be someone else, which is in, you know, that's in Office Space, that's in Fight Club, that's in Boys Don't Cry. All these movies have this underlying idea of kind of liberating yourself to sort of find out who you really are. And I don't think any movie takes that as far and as kind of fantastically as The Matrix does.
I mean, it seemed to me amazing. You have scenes in your book in which you're basically having producers talk about existential questions and the philosophy of Rene Descartes, right?
Right.
You know, as a result of reading this script.
Yeah, and it was a script that some people at Warner Brothers, even as the movie was being made, were like, what is this movie about?
Why are they doing this?
Yeah, they sent these two, you know, fairly new filmmakers out to Australia with a really big budget and a couple of big stars and were like, well, let's hope this turns out for the best. And, it, you know, now we're still living in The Matrix 20 years later, it feels like.
Well, Brian Rafferty, stay with us on Point. Stay with us within The Matrix. We're discussing the movies of 1999. You can join the conversation. What makes a year stand out for you? What's your favorite and why? You may not see dead people, but you're about to hear the music from The Sixth Sense. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the movies of 1999. You can join our conversation. What movies do you remember from that year, two decades ago? What was your take on Office Space, The Best Man, Galaxy Quest? Follow us on Twitter and the Facebook at On Point Radio. With me now, Brian Rafferty. He's a longtime film critic, author of the new book, Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. And Brian, I'm sure it comes as no surprise, people online are pushing back in sometimes the most loving way, but nonetheless. Joe Johnson on Twitter says, 1999, not even the best year that decade, with 94, 95, really good year, but 1946, 1950, 1976, 2012, 2015, 2018 are all better. 99 and 39 are both a little overrated. You know, one of the things that you did was you drew in the book a line between The Matrix and The Wizard of Oz from 1939. What connection do you see there?
I mean, they're both movies about sort of a technicolor world opening up in front of you. And I think they're also kind of examples that, you know, there's sort of parallel tracks of the fact that these are movies made by big studios that were, you know, both The Wizard of Oz and The Matrix, you kind of had to see it in the theater to experience it. And they also both have stayed in the culture. I mean, The Matrix was kind of from the day it opened, it was a movie that was being argued about and discussed on the internet the same way we're discussing and arguing about movies right now. And I think that film, you know, I think every single day for the last 20 years since The Matrix opened, someone has made a Morpheus GIF or a Neo meme online, and just that movie will not go away. And I think The Wizard of Oz sort of shares that kind of permanent space in popular culture.
We have listener on Twitter, Todd Lassa, writes, problem for me is 1999 filled with good movies that were only good once. Never want to watch American Beauty again. I think it was 1974, he writes. Just briefly touching on American Beauty again. You know, Kevin Spacey, more than 30 people have come forward with allegations against Spacey, with accounts ranging from harassment to attempted rape. Spacey pleaded not guilty in January of this year to a felony count of indecent assault and battery for groping an 18-year-old man in 2016 on Nantucket, an island as part of Massachusetts, an odd echo of the scene we played earlier. How does it affect your thinking about the film, what we now have been told or has been claimed about Kevin Spacey?
It's interesting. I mean, it certainly hangs over the film in a way. And there is kind of, looking back now 20 years later, you know, there's also a couple really big Miramax movies that year that were pushed in the public by Harvey Weinstein, who has also had a lot of problems in the last couple of years. And I think it's
and let's be very clear, accused of things from harassment to sexual assault.
Absolutely, monstrous things. I mean, I'm not a Harvey fan.
Right.
So I think it's interesting to try to look at these movies and look at, well, what was their place in the context of that time, and can you draw parallels or draw anything out about them? And I do think American Beauty, it's weird. You know, Kevin Spacey won Best Actor that year. I actually do not love his performance in that movie. I'm not just saying that to beat him up now that he's kind of a public enemy. But, you know, he sort of made a joke about, you know, his, you know, people, his friends sort of, you know, letting him be who he wanted to be. I'm trying to remember what the exact wording was. But, you know, the idea of, like, maybe he was sort of hiding in plain sight in a weird way with this character, it's just – it's so skeevy, sort of spot on and skeevy the way he's kind of playing this person who we now have come to believe is really who he is. Mm-hmm. And I think, like I said earlier, I mean, a lot of the things in that movie that seemed a little strange or soapy at the time, or maybe a little exaggerated, do sort of feel uncomfortably close nowadays.
Mm-hmm. I want to go from big budget movies and big, you know, big, huge stars, American Beauty. We talked earlier about The Matrix, which was a big studio film, to a much smaller thing, Office Space. My colleague, producer Brian Hardzinski, writes, the first time I saw Office Space, I was 13. I didn't get it. I thought it was boring, slow, didn't relate to it at all. Then I got a job and everything changed. I want to play a clip from Office Space. It's a satire of the cubicles and bleakness of 1990s office life. Ron Livingston plays Peter, sort of our hero. He's fed up with his job at a software company. He decides he wants out. Here he explains his thinking to a waitress named Joanna. She wore a lot of flair. And yes, that is the voice of Jennifer Aniston.
I don't like my job, and I don't think I'm going to go anymore.
You're just not going to go?
Yeah.
Won't you get fired?
I don't know, but I really don't like it, and I'm not going to go.
So you're going to quit?
Nuh-uh, not really. I'm just going to stop going.
When did you decide all of that?
About an hour ago.
Really?
Yeah.
About an hour ago. So you're going to get another job?
I don't think I'd like another job.
Well, what are you going to do about money and bills and...
You know, I've never really liked paying bills. I don't think I'm going to do that either.
Brian Raftery, there are two things that stick with me about the movie in particular, one of which is Ron Livingston, as there's sort of a wave of layoffs planned, sort of insisting he doesn't want to work there and not convincing the people doing the firing that they're desperate to keep him at all costs. Yeah. And the second thing is Cole, I'm blanking on his first name.
Oh, Gary Cole.
Gary Cole playing Lumberg as the boss, the deeply not empathetic but thinking he's empathetic boss there. What was Office Space about? It was kind of a bit of a flop, wasn't it? And yet it's just such a cult hit now.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of films from that year, whether it's Office Space or even, you know, Fight Club, which did not do as well as people had really hoped it would, that were not hits. I mean, Office Space played to a couple of near-empty theaters, and I know that because the cast members went to see it opening weekend and there was no one else there. And it was considered a huge flop and was kind of rescued by DVD and rescued by cable. But I think that movie is, you know, Office Space and The Matrix and Fight Club are all sort of part of this kind of kind of white-collar trilogy of that year, where it's these people who are stuck in these office jobs they don't love, and they're trying to find a way out of it, and they eventually have to sort of find something in themselves to kind of liberate themselves. And that's a very fancy way of talking about a movie that also makes jokes about having a case of the Mondays and has Gary Cole doing Lumberg. But it's a very deep movie, and I think that's why it's lasted so long in the last 20 years in the culture.
It's a tremendous little film. It took me a while to get to it, and then I was really struck by it. We've got a lot of people with their own thoughts and are struck by films. We've got a call from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Anne, please share your thoughts.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. In spite of the fact that I love the movie Office Space, it seems like most of your list of movies are full of male characters, male themes, and I guess you are a male putting this list together, and it really highlights the state of movie making in that period of time from which we're trying to scratch our way out now. Every year at the Olympics, or at the, the Oscars, they highlight how few women are getting nominated, and every year we hear how few roles there are for women, and the themes of the movies are not women-related, and this list just seems to highlight that to me.
Well, Anne, thank you very much for your perspective, and let's let Brian Raftery respond to that. 1999, an earlier era during which a lot of the sins of Hollywood that had been called out in the last couple of years were taking place, or certainly was of that moment. How did that affect the films that were put out there? And, you know, do you think that Anne has a point?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, it's a devastating part of film history that, you know, when Hollywood started, there were so many female screenwriters in charge, and it was kind of a not an equal opportunity place, but it certainly seemed to have a lot more opportunities for female voices. And there were, you know, 1999, you had some extraordinary female directed movies. I mean, Kimberly Pierce directed and co-wrote Boys Don't Cry. You know, Sofia Coppola did The Virgin Suicides. Allison McLean did Jesus' Son, which is an amazing movie. But, you know, Jesus' Son is also, like a lot of these films, about, in some ways, a troubled men. And that is maybe one of the big problems of the sort of culture in the late 90s, is that when you have, you know, movie studios mostly dominated by white male execs and filmmakers who are getting by and succeeding who are largely white male execs, you're getting a lot of movies about middle-aged white guys having trouble. And I would like to think that we've moved past that a bit in the last 20 years. I don't think we have. I think you can find some really reassuring films in that year that sort of point to what Hollywood and what the indie world could be like if the studios really tried to accommodate a greater number of voices.
There was among those on your list of best of that year included the movie Election,
yes,
which did have a very strong female lead in it, in Reese Witherspoon. In the movie, she plays Tracy Flick, an overachieving high schooler running for school president. Government teacher Jim McAllister, that's played by Matthew Broderick, thinks there should be more choices. He convinces the popular and dim-witted athlete Paul to run against Tracy. Here, Reese Witherspoon's Tracy confronts Paul, who's played by Chris Klein.
Who put you up to this?
What do you mean?
You just woke up this morning and suddenly decided to run for president?
No. I just thought that,
Thought what?
Well, I was talking to Mr. McAllister about my leg and how I still want to do something for the school, and
so Mr. McAllister asked you to run?
Well, I talked to him and everything, but he just said that he thought it would be a good idea and how there's all different kinds of fruits and, well, it's nothing against you, Tracy. I mean, you're the best. I just thought...
Okay, you're on, Mr. Popular.
I was talking to Mr. McAllister about my leg. Memorable words and reasons to run for office. It's a great movie. What
it's
about that character of Tracy Flick? I mean, she's, it was at the time often described as being kind of like Hillary Clinton. She's a female figure people like to dislike. And yet, you know, she was being wronged throughout this movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that is absolutely my favorite movie, 1999. And I did about 130 interviews for this book with a lot of people, and Election really is kind of at everyone's number one spot, or it's very close. It does feel like the movie that year that everyone can agree on, and I think you heard why. I mean, it's remarkable performances, but it's also Tracy Flick is a phenomenal character. I mean, she is ambitious and smart, and she makes some pretty big moral mistakes, but this movie is also about a young woman who is basically being mistreated by every single man around her, whether it's her teacher or her classmates. It's a remarkable film. And, Yeah, it's one that it's hard not to think about our current political state when you're watching a movie about a very accomplished, intelligent woman who's trying to run for office against a dopey rich guy who doesn't really know what he's doing or why he wants to achieve office, you know?
I'm coming for you, Mr. Popular. Well, coming for you now, Brian Rafferty,
sure.
We have our next guest. Joining me now from Kansas City, Missouri, is Sean Edwards. He's film critic for Fox 4 News, co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association, frequently a guest with us. Sean, great to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Talk to me, Sean Edwards, about 1999. Where does it stand for you? What do you think about this? Obviously, other films, and we'll talk about more over the course of the rest of this hour. But what do you think about 99 and its place in cinematic history?
I mean, 99 was an okay year. I wouldn't cite it as one of the best, not even close. Like a previous caller said or a previous person on Twitter said, it's not even the best year of that decade.
How come?
It can't be the best year ever when the number one movie was an awful Star Wars movie that earned the most money at the box office. I mean, you had an awful Star Wars movie that was released that year. You had a bad James Bond movie that came out that year. You had a subpar Pixar movie that came out that year in Toy Story 2. And like a previous caller said, the representation of all those movies, there's no diversity. There's a lack of women, a lack of African-American representation, a lack of Hispanic representation, And most of these movies don't hold up. I mean, sure, The Matrix was groundbreaking. Sure, that's one. But one movie can't make a year the best year ever for movies.
What do you say to that, Brian?
I mean, they're all fair points. I mean, I certainly think, I did a lot of my key movie watching in the 90s, and I do think of that decade. It is the best year for me, at least. I also do love 94. I mean, that's Pulp Fiction and Heavenly Creatures and Hoop Dreams, which is probably my favorite movie of the entire decade. But, as we discussed, there is a big lack of voices in that year. I mean, there was, you know, one thing that I wrote about in the book quite a bit is that 1999 did have these two really kind of seminal and wonderful African-American made films, The Wood and The Best Man, both of which I think hold up pretty well. And weirdly, The Best Man is kind of The Best Man had a sequel almost more than a decade later. It was almost a proto franchise movie in a way.
So Brian, let's play a clip from that so listeners can be reminded of it. The Best Man centers around a group of old friends gathering together again before a big wedding. Talk of marriage and fidelity dominate an evening poker game when the groom, a philandering professional athlete named Lance, declares his faith in the institution of marriage. Lance is played by Morris Chestnut.
Marriage is sacred. My folks been together 35 years. It means something to me.
I hear that.
Besides, marriage is going to curb that appetite for more women. In case y'all didn't know, marriage is a cure to promiscuity.
In what world?
Yeah, I mean, you said that, man.
Goddamn, man. You would have never known that you graduated summa cum laude. You say some dumb ass shit.
Oh, man, it's a time for everything, players. We're in the real world now, man. The real world, real things.
Real world, real things. Sean Edwards, The Best Man, one of the relatively small number of films made by directors and producers of color highlighted in this particular list. Where does The Best Man sit for you, not just in terms of 99, but in terms of as a film in the roster of African-American movie making?
No, that's a great question. Put it this way. We put together a list of the all-time 100 best black movies ever. Neither The Black Man nor The Wood are on that list.
The Best Man, right?
Yeah, right. The Best Man,
right.
Yeah, it's not on the list. No, The Best Man was not a good movie. It was an okay movie that appealed to a certain demo, but it's not great by any stretch of the imagination.
Siskel, meet Ebert. We're recreating the moment and the show
live. It's not a great movie. I mean, it was a fun movie. It was an entertaining movie to watch. But another problem with The Best Man is also very male. The POV is very male.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, Sean Edwards, if you were to pick a year, where would you go? Where would we find you?
You know where I'm starting first? I'm starting with 2018, last year. Last year was an incredible year. Here's the reason why.
No kidding.
Yes, because you had a bunch of terrific foreign films, Cold War, Roma, Shoplifters, that were groundbreaking, revolutionary, masterpieces at every right. You also had a bunch of terrific movies directed by women, Leave No Trace, The Kindergarten Teacher, I'm Not a Witch, Free Solo, Can You Ever Forgive Me, The Writer. Then you had probably the best year ever for black film, Black Panther. Huge reviews, great reviews. Tremendous box office, Black Klansman, If Bill Street Could Talk. You had breakouts from Sorry to Bother You. Mm-hmm. You had Widows. Mm-hmm. You had Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which was animated.
This was the one for you, right? This was the one for you. So let me quickly ask, what do you say to that, Brian?
Oh, I think we're on the same page. Look, I would add Burning to that list. I'd add First Reformed. I thought the last two years have been great.
Yeah. Let me do this. We're going to come after the break. We are going to return back to the year of 1999, discuss the movies with film critic Brian Rafferty and Sean Edwards. You can join our conversation. What about The Matrix, Three Kings, being John Malkovich? Is 99 really the best year? We're going to hear the answers. But right now, we're going to hear Amy Mann and her song Save Me from Paul Thomas Anderson's 1999 movie Magnolia. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Come on and save me. Why don't you save me? If you could save me from the ranks of the freaks, the suspect they could never love. Except the freaks who suspect they could never love anyone. Except the freaks who could never love anyone.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and we're discussing the movies of 1999. You can join our conversation. Do you really think that one year stands out among all the rest? What movies from 99 stay with you and why? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With us now is Brian Rafferty, film critic and author of Best Movie Year Ever. Also with us here on Point, Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. We've got a lot of interesting comments online. Suzanne Johnson posts on Facebook, I love this show. Thank you. Yes, 99 was amazing. See, Brian, we're getting the support swinging back to you. She writes, it's rare for me to watch movies more than once, but I actually own The Matrix and Fight Club on VHS. Yes, I have a VHS player. I still watch them at least once a year. I even rented a suit to be Trinity for Halloween, one of the characters from The Matrix. Persephone Agricola, or at least that's the nom de plume on Facebook, writes, I hadn't realized that so many of the movies remain perennially relevant to me were from 1999, Fight Club, Office Space, The Matrix. The Mummy continues to be a movie I could watch over again and again. I will say our listener had me until The Mummy. I'm going to take a call now from Boston, Massachusetts. Rock, please go ahead and share your thoughts.
Yes, hello. So I really like bringing up The Matrix, particularly in the modern day when issues of transgender rights are in the forefront of a lot of dialogue, because apparently, this is something that I've learned, there are a lot of transgender allegories within the text of The Matrix. The transition from The Matrix to the real world has visual aspects that look somewhat like transition surgery and the hormonal treatment, as well as visual ideas of a rebirth, as well as many of the dialogue lines between the agent and the various characters who have escaped the Matrix often take the form of discussing what transgender voices are like and how they are silenced in the modern society. So seeing that it's still relevant today because of its transgender issues and the ideas that it presents is really interesting to me, and that it's really ahead of its time in that kind of way.
Thank you for that, Rock. I really appreciate you bringing that up. And Brian, I think you interviewed the Wachowski siblings, right, who were the writers, directors, producers, effectively, of the film, in talking through the film for the book. And you allude to the transition they themselves made.
Well, I actually did not get to talk to the Wachowskis. They do not do a lot of interviews. So I spoke to a lot of people who worked on The Matrix. They were not available.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, certainly what's interesting to me is the fact that, as that caller pointed out, The Matrix, I think maybe of all these films, is the one that has this sort of most long-lasting and deepest-reaching allegorical possibilities. And certainly in the last couple of years, as we've learned about the Wachowskis and their own lives, viewing it as a transgender allegory has become very prominent in a lot of academic circles and online. And I actually wonder if that was going on even right after it was released. I really wonder. I'd love to talk to someone who maybe was clued into that as early as 1999, because certainly in the years after The Matrix came out, immediately there were books about The Matrix and philosophy. There were books about The Matrix and religion. There were so many ways of reading The Matrix that I think that's why it's lasted this long, because if you have a conversation about it, the odds are pretty strong that you're going to be talking about something very different than the person sitting across from you.
So let's talk about a movie that actually explicitly addresses this. Boys Don't Cry is based on the real-life story of a young transgender man, Brandon Tina, who was raped and murdered in Humboldt, Nebraska in 1993. In the movie, Hilary Swank plays Brandon, and here in this scene, Brandon is showing his cousin Lonnie, played by Matt McGrath, a photo of his new love, Lana.
Isn't she beautiful?
I feel like white trash.
I'm gonna ask her to marry me.
Before or after your sex change operation? Before or after you tell her that you're a girl?
Shut up. It's different. It's working. No, I'm not gonna f*** up this time.
Sean Edwards, tell me about Boys Don't Cry.
It's an amazing movie. Perhaps, for me, the best movie of 1999. I mean, Hilary Swank was incredible in the movie. The themes that it explored were way ahead of its time. It was just a groundbreaking film on every level.
When you say it broke ground, tell me why it broke ground, and tell me where you see its influence in years that followed.
Well, because I think it's one of the first films that sort of like authentically and honestly like addressed the issues of being transgender. I mean, because the script was so strong, the characters were so real, and you had never really seen a film do it in the way that this movie did. And it opened the door for discussion. It opened the door for future movies to be made about this subject matter.
You know, if you remember all the conversation about the show Transparent that was on, I think, on Amazon just a few years ago, Jeffrey Tambor and many others, you know, that was seen as really groundbreaking and in some ways precedent shattering. But Boys Don't Cry did this in 1999.
Right.
I think, Brian Raftery, you have a scene in your movie in which Hilary Swank is walking around the streets of, I think it's Santa Monica, trying to look like a man, her breasts bound up as tightly as possible. She's trying to think about and imagine what it would be to go through this transition.
Yeah, and this was a very hard movie to make. Kimberly Pierce, who directed it and co-wrote it, spent almost 5 years researching the story. She went and traveled and met with some of Brandon's old friends. She interviewed them. She interviewed Lana. And she could not get this movie made. And it's a real testament to her and Christine Vachon and Brad Simpson, who are some of the producers, that they stayed with this film and got it into theaters on a very tiny budget with an unknown star. And, you know, I'm with Sean. This is one of my favorite movies of that year. And I think one thing to remember is that this came out about a year after Matthew Shepard was murdered, and that was a front page story. You know, that was a cover mm-hmm. story of Time magazine. And I think for people my age, and I was only a couple years older than Matthew Shepard, that was a really horrific event. And I think I remember feeling really pummeled by Boys Don't Cry, because I think it was a reminder of just how fragile sort of a lot of our social contracts are, and how we had to sort of have a greater awareness and to try to learn about one another. And I also think it's a great movie about young people trying to make their way. It's a movie about someone who shows up in a small town and finds his people. And it's a remarkable movie about the bonds that young people make.
It's also the one movie released in 1999 that holds up the best. I give you The Matrix. Let me preface this. The Matrix is one of the greatest movies ever made. I actually like all three of The Matrix movies. So I agree with Brian on that. But Boys Don't Cry holds up very well, even in 2019.
So one of the things we try to do on this show is hold people accountable, powerful, powerful people accountable, even movie critics accountable. We have a call now from Arno, Maine. Owen is 12 years old, and he is calling in defense of one of the big films of 1999. Owen, welcome to On Point. So great to have you.
Hi. So I just wanted to say that I thought Phantom Menace was a very, very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it had – yes?
No, go ahead, please. We want to hear. Tell us about what you liked about the movie.
Especially the pod racing scene and a lot of the effects for the ships were very good. I know a lot of movies around that time, in my opinion, like especially like movies that were like sci-fi, had pretty poor effects for like space, like space shuttles and other crafts. And so I definitely feel like The Phantom Menace did a very, very good job of having very good effects.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the plot was also very good and shed some light on Anakin's background.
And can I ask you one question before we let you go, Owen? I assume you've had the chance to watch a lot of the more recent Star Wars films that have come out. How does Phantom Menace hold up against them?
I definitely like George Lucas quite a bit better than Disney. The prequels were very like bogged down with CGI, in my opinion. But I feel like The Phantom Menace, they didn't use so much CGI that it was bad. So I definitely feel like The Phantom Menace was a lot better than some of the other Star Wars movies now and a couple of ones that came out before that. So I feel like The Phantom Menace was a very good movie.
I really appreciate that. Thank you for sharing, Owen. You are on it. You know your stuff. We appreciate it. Guys, who to go to first? Sean Edwards, defend yourself.
No, I mean, I love it. I love his energy. I mean, and from his perspective, he's dead on. And that was another thing I was going to say about when you choose a movie to be the best movie ever for film, it's a generational thing. Like, you know, for the kid that just got off air, you know, 1 year could mean something different than someone my age as opposed to someone who may be a little bit older than me. Because I think the greatest year is when you have that first true connection with film.
It must have been very striking for him. He was -8 years old when it came out, right?
Exactly. But it's when you discover that, you know, that love for film.
Let me just say, I'm going to give this guy tremendous props. I mean, he knew the difference between the oeuvre of George Lucas when he was on his own versus when Disney owns the franchise. Like, I mean, I just want you to look over your shoulders every now and then. That's all
I
wish saying.
I could talk about movies as passionately and as articulately at 12 as Owen could.
Exactly.
All right. So let's move on from the, you know, the biggest budget movie of the year, one of them, to one of the smallest and most intimate. In Being John Malkovich, a puppeteer Craig Schwartz discovers a portal, a literal door in the wall of his office that leads into the mind of the real renowned actor John Malkovich. Craig Schwartz is played by John Cusack. Craig and his coworker Maxine, who's played by Catherine Keener, begin charging strangers an entrance fee to crawl through the portal and to become John Malkovich. Here, they talk with a customer.
Now, when you say that I can be somebody else, what do you mean exactly?
Well, we mean exactly that. We can put you inside someone else's body for 15 minutes.
Can I be anybody that I want to be?
Well, you... Actually...
You can be John Malkovich.
It's perfect! It's my second choice, but it's wonderful. I'm a fat man. I'm sad and I'm
$200.
Yes.
Okay, gotta crawl in there.
Brian Raftery makes you wonder who the first choice of this aspiring customer is. where did this movie come from?
It's Spike Jonze's first feature film, which is, you know, like I said earlier, you know, so many directors got their first shot in 1999. And it's from Charlie Kaufman, who, you know, similar to Boys Don't Cry, this is a movie that had started in the mid-90s and took forever to get made. And Charlie Kaufman was a guy who was writing for TV and didn't love it and had this remarkable script that I think – for me, being John Malkovich, it just feels like it was made 5 minutes from now. So many of the ideas in that movie about taking over someone's life, about switching identities. I mean, there's a transgender subplot in being John Malkovich as well with Cameron Diaz's character. It is so forward thinking and looking, and it is so deeply, deeply funny that if election's my number one, Malkovich is almost always hovering in the number two spot for that year.
What do you think, Sean Edwards?
No, I mean, only Spike Jonze could have done this movie. Amazingly, it's his first feature, and it's perhaps his best. I don't think he's topped himself since the movie. It's just an incredible – that script by Charlie Kaufman, one of the best written ever. I mean, there's so many nuances. It's layered. I mean, every time you watch it, even still, you discover something new about the movie. And it was so bizarre. When I first screened it way back in 1999, I had no idea what I was watching, but I loved every second of it.
1999 was also a year of, where directors were playing a little havoc with viewers' expectations. There was The Sixth Sense made by M. Night Shyamalan. It's a psychological thriller, and it stars a young boy named Cole Sear, Haley Joel Osment. He's haunted by ghosts. He's too afraid to tell anyone except in this emblematic scene, he shares his secret with a child psychologist, Dr. Malcolm Crowe, played by Bruce Willis.
I see dead people.
In your dreams? While you're awake? Dead people, like, in graves and coffins?
Walking around like regular people. They don't see each other. They only see what they want to see. They don't know they're dead.
Sean Edwards, it's been 20 years. Do we reveal the twist at the end of this movie or not?
I don't know. We may have a young listener, like the kid who was just on air who hasn't seen it yet.
That's right. No. With streaming movies, it's like everything's a spoiler alert. You can't say how Casablanca ends, right?
Right, exactly. I was just okay with The Sixth Sense. Uh-huh. I mean, I know it was a sensation when it came out because of the twist at the end, but it did not blow me away when it was initially released.
Can I just say I felt the same? We only have about a minute so left, but I felt the same about The Blair Witch Project, where, you know, I'm not a huge fan of horror, but, like, you know, it was a verite thing and I got it. And yet at the same time, I felt deeply underwhelmed. Brian Raftery, in the 30, 40 seconds we have left, why was this film such a powerhouse of a film even made on a shoestring in 1999?
I think it's because, you know, thanks to the power of the internet, some people didn't know whether it was real or fake. And I have to say, I know you didn't go for it, but I watched it in a Midtown Manhattan screening room that summer almost by myself, and I knew it was fake. And I still remember clutching the armrest. Like, whatever the power of that movie was, it absolutely worked on me in a big way.
Well, we've been talking this hour with two people who know a lot about films, different views, but interesting, complex both. Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. Sean, great to have you on today.
Yeah, thanks once again. I really appreciate it.
And we've been listening also to Brian Raftery. He's a longtime film and cultural critic, author of the new book, Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. Brian, really fun to chat.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it.
We're going to go out with a little 1999 from Prince. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point, we're produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poley, Grace Tatter, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Adam Waller. With help from Adam Hoisch, Alex Pena, and Sydney Wertheim, our executive producer. It's Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.